Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is already well known to Oldie readers as a long-standing contributor about absolutely everything to do with cooking, food and recipes. She's also a broadcaster and has been a food columnist for numerous magazines, has written about 15 cookbooks and a couple of what she calls doorstopper novels, and four memoirs, including recipes, about her very full and varied family life that has taken her all over Europe and beyond. She also happens to be a very accomplished botanical artist and painter. Her curiosity about all types of food is inspirational, and there's absolutely nothing she won't try her hand at cooking. Suffice to say, the last time I visited her at home in Acton, I was treated to the best cheese toastie I've ever had, preceded by snails that she had prepared herself with fennel seeds. If you haven't guessed whom I'm talking about already, it's a delight to introduce our listeners to Elizabeth Luard. Elizabeth, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Hello, Charlotte.
Now, Elizabeth, your life is so full that it's hard to know where to start except the beginning. You were born in London during the war, but your father died when you were a baby and your brother was just two. So tell me a bit about your early life.
Probably can't remember much until I was 5 years old, something like that. So when I was five, my mother married again. And then almost immediately we went to Uruguay because he was a trainee diplomat. I was 11. And Uruguay was fun because it was in Montevideo. And in Montevideo, the school everybody went to was the Anglo-Uruguayan school. And we were taught in English in the morning and in Spanish in the afternoon. And also because I was a stepchild. And my mother wasn't very child-friendly.
You've said that. You've written about that. In fact, you said she didn't love you.
I think she probably didn't. She didn't really like children. She had to have them because they were good for a marriage or, you know, anyway, it happened. But our mother really liked boys, which left me actually in rather fortunate position because nobody really was doing much about telling me what to do. So I spent a lot of time in the kitchen. So it was either the diplomatic and green baize doors and English food and stuff like that on the wrong side, as far as I was concerned.
Yes.
And on the kitchen side, there were actually chickens under the table and a general kind of feeling of Spanishness, you know, great kindness. And there wasn't much kindness on the other side. So naturally, I probably gravitated to the kitchen really young.
And can you remember the first thing, delicious thing that you ate in the kitchen that was not delivered beyond the green baize door?
There's a thing called zapallitos. Zapallitos is a little marrow, little round marrow, and it has to be scooped out. And you can get finger-shaped ones that also had to be scooped out. And children's fingers could do this. You know, you got a little spoon and you could do it.
With tiny seeds.
Tiny spoon. And then that would be stuffed with rice or whatever it was. And the fact that I could do that was a source of pride.
But then you were sent off to a very, very conventional young ladies' education, weren't you? Finishing school and all sorts of things. Tell us about that.
Well, the first one was I was 11 when we got back, and I went off to Lawnside. And Lawnside was a girls' school in the Malvern Hills. And you weren't supposed to have a brain. And most of us had been thrown out of a different school before we were sent off to Lawnside. My mother never visited it.
She never came to see that.
No, I can proudly say that my mother never went anywhere near it. Every now and again, she used to write me a letter, which was probably a response to whatever the headmistress was complaining about, which will have been quite a lot, I imagine.
Why? Were you naughty? Or?
I never thought I was naughty, but apparently I must have been. School report, I think I was 15, which was the last one I had because I was out of school by then, which was top of the class, top of the class, top of the class, top of the class. And at the end of it, it said deportment. And then it said something really rude about me. Doesn't take criticism, possibly, but also dumb insolence.
Dumb insolence.
And I remember looking at it and thinking,
insolence
is possible. Mm. I could hold my hands up and that is possible. But dumb? No, you got me wrong there.
I mean, mercifully, you were out of that. And then weren't you sent to a proper Lucy Clayton type?
I didn't go to Lucy Clayton, but I was going to go to be a debutante in order, as my mother rather hoped, that I might be taken off her hands.
Josh, what date was that?
That was 1958, something like
so
that.
They
started with Queen Charlotte's Ball, so we were all wearing white, and we walked down this set of steps in the Dorchester or somewhere like that. It was the Dorchester, and we curtsied to a cake. Why would you curtsy to a cake? You had to have a young man who escorted you downstairs in a sort of...
Who escorted you? Can you remember?
Can't remember. And we all wore white in order to explain that we were virgins. But by then I had mistakenly, my mother had got it a bit wrong. She'd got it wrong on three counts. One was to send me to the Eastbourne School of Domestic Economy instead of sending me to Constance Pry Wingfield, where you learnt to curtsy, and you learnt to arrange flowers, and you learnt to make canopies. Mm-hmm. You see, and the Eastbourne School of Domestic Economy didn't do that. What it did was train you to cater for the Navy. So I returned to my mother, and she said, "Darling, what can you do?" She did call me darling. Arrange the flowers. And I said, "No, I've learnt how to reconstruct whale blubber as cream and how to make shepherd's pie for the Navy."
And to do housework, you said somewhere.
You're absolutely right. I've forgotten about the housework. It's really useful. I learned how to iron shirts, obviously.
That is useful, yeah.
Male shirts, mm-hmm. Not mine.
Collars and cuffs.
Button the other way around, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I do it even now. If a male shirt comes into my hands, I do it in the way that I was taught to do it, like a little Pavlov dog.
You said that after these various forays into further education, no university, of course, because girls didn't go there.
No, but I did manage to get into the Sorbonne, but I wasn't supposed to. And I had somehow managed to get hold of a young man called Gilles, who had a Vespa. And he was a friend of my brother's who was educated in Switzerland. So Gilles was actually enrolled in the Sorbonne, and so I got on the back of Gilles' Vespa, and off we went, and at that point nobody stopped you doing things, like entering places you weren't supposed to be. So I potted into the Sorbonne, looked around, see who was teaching, and found Simone de Beauvoir.
You went to a Simone de Beauvoir class?
Yeah, I did. I used to go to her lectures.
Wow, what was that like? What was she like?
Well, it was feminism. It was absolutely roaring,
yes.
And it totally sang to my soul.
Yeah.
Not a problem, And so by the time I got back and was supposed to be a debutante, I was...
But you didn't register anything, you just visited.
No, you just walked in. So I was completely radicalised, of course, wearing long black stocking, short skirts, false eyelashes, and wanted to be Julie Greco,
Yes.
By the time I got back to London, to be a debutante wearing tulle and, pretending that these young men I was supposed to talk to were going to be interesting. And the only ones who were interested in me were the fathers.
How come you got a typing job at Private Eye? How did that all happen?
Well, at the age of... sort of 17, 18, having finished the debutante business and managed not to get myself up the aisle. And I had shorthand typing. Wonderful.
Where did you learn to do that?
Queens.
Queens, of course.
Queens. Here we are. And I was really fast. So when I went onto the job market, I discovered that... some old bloke who was behind a desk would try and promote me as his personal assistant, which seemed to involve out-of-hours behaviour. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do indeed. I mean, I think a lot of oldies, women oldies, we all started as type. I certainly started life as a typist. Mm. Thank God for typing. How useful was that?
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. Absolutely wonderful. Yeah. But I used to take jobs in order to avoid being promoted. You know, I was pretty, I wore short skirts.
Promoted to the bedroom, yes.
Yeah, and I used to take jobs in estate agents' offices underneath in the typing pool. Because I could get in at 9 o'clock, I could leave at 5 o'clock, and nobody was chasing me around the desk. They just paid me.
Yes.
So, and I could have fun doing what else I was doing. Mm. And then, in the way that fun doing what else I was doing involved my own generation of the private eye, that, you know, of Booker. Ingram's was there, Rushton was there, but the... Beyond the Fringe had begun.
Mm.
So there was already that kind of movement and that feeling of that things were changing.
Mm-hmm.
And Private Eye was, at that point, a little yellow rag. And they thought I was posh totty and wouldn't be in before midday. So, okay, I had an income. I think it was a fiver a week, something like that. But that was decent money,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
And... So I enrolled in the City and Guilds art school, and where it was free. And my mother and stepfather and the rest of the family were all in Mexico by now. So I was kind of...
Where were you living?
I was in Dolphin Square. My mother thought that was very respectable. Two doors down from Mandy Rice Davis. So I go in the morning when they check you in, and then leave at midday when they didn't check you back in again in the afternoon. So in the morning in art school, and then to Private Eye in the afternoon. And that worked perfectly well. And I was absolutely in the middle of Soho.
Where was it? Greek Street or somewhere like that?
Well, the first one was on the other side of Cambridge Circus. It was in Neal Street.
Oh, yes, yes.
And then it was... It was a warehouse which we had been loaned. And then we moved to Greek Street, which was opposite the establishment. And the establishment was Satirical Nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And Peter Cook was, you know, and Dudley was there in the basement playing the piano.
Oh, marvellous. Yeah.
And Christopher Logue was around with his...
poetry.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. He was writing songs. There's a marvellous CD of songs from the establishment. There was a band, and Annie Ross of Lambert, Hendricks and Ross, wonderful jazz singer, was singing Christopher's lyrics.
Gosh.
Yeah. And above the establishment, which, of course, I immediately zeroed into, above the establishment was a bar and a kind of sitting-out area. And Michael Hastings, the playwright, was choosing the paintings. So Scarfe was there, probably Stedman was there. They were all, you know, they were caricatures and that. So it was really very interesting and very thrilling.
Yes.
And upstairs was Lewis Morley, who took the photograph of Christine Keeler.
The one with the chair, where she's sitting
with the chair. One with the chair. Actually, big secret, she was actually wearing her undies.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry about that. Because Lewis Morley...
Every oldie is going to be so disappointed.
I know. Terrible. Anyway, she was actually wearing her undies. It was in the middle of a shoot, which was being done for something that Nicholas... who was then the Nicholas Luard.
Tell us about meeting him, because you said, you wrote somewhere that he was the most beautiful man you'd ever seen.
I know, yeah, he was. And anyway, so Nicholas was, he was one of the fringe, and his good friend was Peter Cook. So when the eyewear ran out of money, so I was sent down to see if I could sweet talk. I mean, it's real blokey stuff, isn't it? Honestly. To see if I could sweet talk the proprietor of the establishment to...
Who was Nicholas Luard,
because it was...
Was that the first time you met him, when you were sent down to chat him up?
Yeah,
and you just... Were you just struck dumb by his beauty?
Yeah, that's it, really. Don't care about the brain. You know, I'm 18. Don't care about the brain. Just want that one. Really gorgeous.
And how long did it take to get him?
Well, I think that... you know, what did I just sort of gave up the other kind of fancies that were around the place. And then kind of things began to happen at the establishment, and Nicholas started a magazine called Scene, which employed Tom Stoppard as its theatre critic, under the name Henry Boot. And it cost rather a lot of money, and the establishment began to be taken over by Soho Hoods and that kind of thing. Raymond Nash, there were bad people around. And, I mean, it was a sort of impossible situation, probably. But it was all getting a bit troublesome, and I wasn't getting a lot of attention from Nicholas. And I had a... He had his own flat, which contained two rather pretty women, you know, which he said were, you know, just sort of happened to be there, didn't have anywhere else to be.
Where was his flat? In Soho?
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It was Hyde Park Square.
Oh.
So, sort of kind of there. And it was one of those big buildings. It was
yes.
There was a lot going on. And I thought, well, I'm going off to Mexico. And my stepfather was probably number two or three in the embassy. So I took a job as a shorthand typist in the embassy, to the cultural attaché. And Nicholas would... He had a habit of sending telegrams, which would be arrive in the middle of the night in three stages, page two, page one, then page three, which actually drove my mother crazy. So when he eventually pitched up with a marriage proposal, my mother was fed up, didn't think he was appropriate he'd gone to Winchester and he was sort of okay and good Cambridge first-class English and things like that. That was sort of okay. But wasn't okay was the satire, you know, and the king of satire was what he was being described as in the Daily Mail and other places. And that was, my mother said, well, I suppose I better congratulate you. And so I was 21 when I got married.
So anyway, you then went on to have a married life for 40 years.
Yeah, I did. I had four children. I took them all to Andalusia because people were nice to children in among the Latins. And I loved my children. I thought they were brilliant. Mm. I liked the anarchy.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, you have a daughter.
Yes,
and they are
too,
ungovernable.
You're telling me.
Absolutely ungovernable. Yes. So you can either enjoy the fact that they're completely ungovernable, or you can give up. So probably I wasn't looking too closely at what Nicholas was up to.
No.
Which is probably quite a good thing.
But you've written about that very movingly and quite a lot, about how you chose really not to look too closely. And there was a moment when you did leave him for a bit, wasn't there?
Yeah, no, much more. I just sort of, off you go. I mean, you'd spent... I got a decent little diary, and that had all disappeared into various holes. And the house that we had in Spain was also on the line with the banks. And he was behaving really badly within the household.
And drinking extremely heavily. Drinking like a...
Oh, yeah, drinking. But that wasn't the real problem.
No.
Because I wouldn't have noticed that so much as I would have noticed the fact that, you know... there seemed to be rather a lot of ladies. And I just thought, OK, that's it, you know, off you go. Marriage is as complicated. The middle bit of marriages is when it all breaks down.
And you compared that wonderfully somewhere to cooking. It takes patience in the middle bit, you said.
The middle bit, I know, the middle bit. But the middle bit is better left, you know, stick it in the oven, come back in a couple of hours, you know.
So, but you did come back together again, didn't you? And then
he moved to
Scotland.
We were in London, and we had a rent-controlled house, flat, the top of Wilbraham Place near Sloane Square. He'd sit, when he got nothing better to do, on the steps of this Wilbraham apartment block, with a bottle of champagne and a bunch of flowers. So eventually I said, OK. And I took a young man, younger than me. I took a, you know, that was sort of, I was just really fed up with nobody being nice to me or liking me. And so that, you know, that probably meant that I could forgive him. If I hadn't done that, I might have been really, really cross. So it was much more of a deal. It was a sort of rather than getting back together, and the fact that... it was necessary to rebuild a career for him. You know, he was a writer. He was already a writer, but I think one of his books had been turned down, so it was a bit dodgy. So I would usually finish the books, because you don't get paid unless you turn in the finished book.
Yes.
So the first book, when our life together resumed, and it was, he liked writing books about Africa. He was really lazy. He never used to do the sort of, never used to read the books. I mean, I liked doing that, so I'd go off to the Royal Geographic. So when he started to write a new book about Africa, I said, OK, I'll do a chapter and you do a chapter. So Gondar, which up there, you probably see it there, was probably the one that made the most money and was very successful. Started as a one chapter, another chapter, another chapter. Mm. And then he took it on in the way that it sort of kick-started. And I think there are probably quite a lot of wives of husbands who write who will have had that similar input. We just do whatever you need to do to get the work done.
And had you started writing your own books then?
I started with a piece in The Spectator in 1978. I was botanical artist for Miriam Rothschild.
Amazing.
The biologist Miriam Rothschild.
Yes.
I used to drive her around. And so I'd gone to Israel to drive her around. She didn't like driving. She was working on a book on fleas, the histology of fleas, for which she made her name, and she was working with scientists in the Weizmann. All the money was coming from the Saudis or from Jordan or from the Egyptians to, you know, to do the work. And so I thought that was interesting because pretty much Israel was at war. So when I got back to London, I rang up Alexander Chancellor and said, I want to write a piece for you about the cooperation between the Israelis and the Arab world. So he said, okay. So that was my first outing in 1978. And then Simon Courtauld, who now my companion on the Oldie, he went to edit The Field.
Oh.
And he rang me up and said, do you want to write a column with your drawings? So that was how I got my start as a food writer. And then okay, do you want to write a book? Yes, I want to write a book. What book do you want to write? I said, well, I don't think anyone's going to publish it. But it's the title...
15 books later, yes.
At that point, it was European Peasant Cookery. And people will not want the word peasant because it's pejorative, and that's why I want it. So I was obviously still...
dumb insolence.
Dumb insolence, there you go. And an agent who was, you know, really very supportive. And there were three bidders. I got enough money to write the book. So an European Peasant Cookery is still in print. And it was published in 1984, I think, in this country. The memoirs came from the fact that I'd written a book which had a lot of memoir in it. On I went. And then the eldest daughter, Francesca, who was doing a shopping column on the Daily Mail. Her degree was from London Uni, King's, in biology. And it was a time when HIV was becoming known about. And bingo, bad picker, and she managed to get it.
I wanted to talk to you about her getting AIDS because in one of your memoirs, which I've read, it's you write so movingly about Francesca.
The book was already in contract and pretty much almost ready for delivery by the time Fran got her diagnosis, which will have been in 1992, something like that. And at that point I said to my agent, OK, you've got to get me out of this.
Yeah.
You know, I cannot do Family Life, a book called Family Life. And this is what this is what's coming down the road.
Yeah.
At a time when everybody knew, it was fatal, you know. And Fran knew that. So on we went. Fran stopped her column in the Daily Mail and she went off and enrolled in the Byam Shaw to be a painter. And she didn't have it. I don't think she even had a an O-level in art, and she just painted maybe a dozen portraits of herself wearing a hat, looking sideways, just head and shoulders, mm-hmm. and applied to the Vaughan I'm sure, and just took these paintings and stacked them around the wall and said, OK, when do I start? So on she went, and that was pretty much what she did. So
for how long till she got too ill to carry on?
She had two lives. One was in Notting Hill, where her status was known, and, believe it or not, somewhat envied. There's a sort of glamour to something that marks you out. You know, the doctors were terrified.
Yes.
You know, there was a lot of masking and...
Yes.
And
people didn't know how you caught it. You thought even a handshake might do
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. And which was why Diana, Princess of Wales...
Did absolutely, so much.
You know, she just changed everything.
Yeah.
And before then, you know, the advice was you had to put separate knives and forks, a different mug... And Fran just, and I'd come back from being told what to do, and Fran said, OK, Mark, you know, what are they saying? He said, well, you know, you've got to do this, and you've got to do the your own plate and your own everything and your own mug. And by then we had a house in Wales, so we were coming and going. There was a Welsh dresser with mugs along, the, you know, on hooks. And I took some... red nail varnish and painted a heart on Fran's mug. And Fran said, what do you do that for? I said, well, you know, this is what they say and you've got to have your own mug. And Ma said, well, Fran said, well, Ma, if that's what's going to happen, then everybody in the world's going to get it. So just, you know, take a deep breath. And she took the nail varnish and she put little hearts on all the mugs.
Oh.
So when she finally, you know, we'd been through the whole number that you go through and she'd died... And we had to clear it up, the little flat that she had. And her brother opened her the door, the drawer beside her bed, where there was a foolscap, you know, typewritten, about probably 10,000 words, maybe, maybe less, maybe 5,000, which was for publication. That was what she wanted. And her brother, Cass, lived in New York, and he said it should be published because it's the account of her diagnosis, of the situation that she's in, and pretty much right up to the last week.
Yes.
And I looked at it and said, OK, I didn't want it published as a standalone in a magazine or a newspaper or whatever, because I didn't think that was appropriate, because you wouldn't know Fran.
No.
So... And there was a point when it was said, OK, one in four in the world will get this disease,
yes.
At which point I thought, I have four children.
Mm.
And so went back to family life, and it had a title now, which was Birth, Death and the Whole Damn Thing. And by the time you get to Fran's explanation of her... diagnosis and that piece that's Fran's, you hear her voice,
yes.
And you already know her. And the final one is the last week of her, when she couldn't obviously write, and it was her final week. And I wrote that within literally days of the, you know, of something to do as much as anything. Okay. And probably made notes and... I never touched it again, and I can't read it again now.
No.
I didn't edit it at all. It's just, you know, this is what he was.
Mm.
So that's the story of family life.
And what now? You're living on your own in a newish. How long have you lived here?
2017, I moved from Wales.
So into this flat?
Into this flat, yep. The middle daughter, Fran's younger sister... she found it. She knew pretty much what would suit me, and she rang me up and she said, well, it's like a posh student's flat.
It is like a posh student's flat.
So
it's very cool. It's got a platform, it's got a bed up on a platform.
It's very cool. It was really funny. And she rang me up, and I was back in Wales, and we'd been sort of rather giving up on the whole thing. And she said, OK, I've got it, so can you put the money down, because otherwise it'll go. So I said, OK. So I put the money down.
Without having seen it?
Yeah.
Marvellous.
And really, really It's a room of my own.
It's a room of your own?
Yes!
But you've been through a lot of extraordinary hardship in your life. You know, I mean, you've had a mother you say didn't love you, you've had your beloved daughter. What's the secret of you being so cheerful? I mean, you do seem very happy, genuinely. What's the secret?
Stupidity.
No, that bollocks.
Sorry not the dumb swear point.
On radio old bollocks.
Dumb, insolent, I don't know.
Maybe.
Dumb, insolent. I don't know, because actually people do think that if you're happy, you must be stupid. They do. I know they do. So that's an easy answer, isn't it? Because why am I happy? Apparently my father was happy.
Oh, your father you don't remember at all? Because he died.
No, I don't, but I did ask his Aunt Jan. So she was his elder sister. And I did actually say to her, you know, was he a happy person? Mm. Because it seems to be something you're born with. I'm not
that's
sure
so
if it's actually a, you know, and therefore it's a different, you know, it's not a virtue.
It's like a setting.
Yes. And it's yes, you get a good fairy who says, okay, you're going to be happy. And the rest of the rubbish, you know, you can deal with because you are going to be happy.
I don't suppose you've ever been bored for a second, have you?
No.
No.
No, no, because I've got something interesting to do or yes. Somebody to talk to in the bus queue.
Somebody to cook for.
Somebody to cook for, but that actually... I cook for me.
Mm.
Because why wouldn't you?
Mm.
You know, if you can have two or three really, you know, happy things to happen to you every day, why wouldn't you?
Mm.
Funny.
Well, how marvellous. Elizabeth, thank you so much for talking to me on Radio Old. It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
A pleasure, Charlotte.
You've been listening to Charlotte Metcalfe in conversation with the author, journalist, broadcaster and tireless enthusiast for all things food-related, Elizabeth Luard. If you've enjoyed listening, you'll find more like this on Radio Oldie by visiting www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to you, Elizabeth Luard, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.